encourage you to join them in supporting WILL. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences of all ages to experience the lively fiddling and entertaining step dancing of Natalie McMaster on January 26th. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Martin Luther King is well known, certainly, for battling against racial discrimination. Less well known is that near the end of his life, King began to work more broadly on the issue of poverty, not just for black Americans, but for all Americans. This morning, in this hour of focus, we will try to look at some of the aspects of King's thought that have often been overlooked, including his ideas about class in America and also his opposition to the Vietnam War. And our guest will be Rufus Burrow. He is Indiana Professor of Christian Thought at Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis. He is, among other things, interested in the theological ethics of Martin Luther King. And in fact, he's authored a book that explores his ideas, that is, King's ideas, who were his important influences. The title of the book is God and Human Dignity. The subtitle is The Personalism, Theology, and Ethics of Martin Luther King, Jr. It is published by the University of Notre Dame Press. Professor Burrow is joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Burrow, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Good. Fine. Good. I'm fine.
I appreciate you giving us some of your time. You know, we, as we do this program, our ideas, we try to pick up ideas many different sorts of places. And this show here, I think we started thinking about this when a couple of months back, it would have been in April, at around the time that people were marking the anniversary of the death of Dr. King, we saw a couple of essays that we thought that were interesting. And basically, they made the same sort of point. That is that when we think of Dr. King, we think about his importance in civil rights and in the civil rights movement. And yet he did, throughout the course of his life, did change his focus somewhat. Certainly he became a vocal opponent of the Vietnam War that was controversial then. And he said some ideas that perhaps said some things that perhaps were controversial then and are still kind of controversial. Things having to do with basic issues of poverty. And the point of these essays was that perhaps we have overlooked, maybe even intentionally overlooked, those parts of his thinking that are more controversial. That is, we concentrate on the civil rights part, but it's almost as if we've forgotten the other part. And just as a way of beginning, I am interested in whether you, in fact, think that that's true.
Well, I'm not certain that I do. I think in the first place, it might be a good idea to try to develop a sense that King's focus didn't really change. Hmm. Rather, I think what ultimately happened is it expanded. Hmm. So consequently, when he begins, for example, in the struggle in Montgomery, the bus boycott, the focus is primarily on the area of race, and that is a focus that never really changed throughout his 12-year ministry. But what we do find is that the focus began to expand, because after Montgomery, King gets involved in a number of the other campaigns throughout the South, Birmingham, Selma, Albany, and a number of others. And what we discover is that while he begins his emphasis on the race question, he discovers in Birmingham, for example, that there was a very serious class issue or economic issue going on. And so his outlook, his socio-ethical outlook, begins to expand at that point. Now, that's not to say that even during Montgomery, King was not aware that there were class issues there, because he was, but that becomes heightened by the time we get around to Montgomery and some of the other campaigns in the South. Well, then we discover that a few years later, particularly in the early to mid-1960s, there comes this this much stronger emphasis on the issue of militarism, as he liked to refer to it, or war. And the truth of the matter is that even back in 1949 or thereabouts, when he was still in seminary, the interesting thing is we see even there in papers that he wrote for classes, as well as sermons that he was issuing at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, we see an emphasis on those three issues, or at least in those days he was talking about wanting to focus on those issues throughout his ministry. So that he talks in 1949 very briefly about the issue of race. He talks about the issue of class or economic exploitation, and he talks about the need to be done with war. And I find that very interesting that, you know, from the time of his student days, his days as a seminary student at Crozer Theological Seminary in Chester, Pennsylvania, that he was already concerned about those types of issues. But then when Montgomery comes around, of course, he's kind of cast into the leadership position of that. Mm-hmm. And so, consequently, the emphasis at that time was on race. And I'd say that by the time King is assassinated in Memphis on April 4th, 1968, he still had that that racial emphasis. But by that time, we all know that his socio-ethical outlook had expanded considerably, and most particularly where the war in Vietnam was concerned. So I'm not quite certain that that people intentionally overlook some of those later what they experience as some of those later emphases in King's work. But it is clear to me that by the time we get to about 1966, King has gone through some pretty radical transitions and changes at that time. And I think that he has a much clearer sense by then of the interrelatedness of each of those issues that he had focused on almost from the beginning. Mm.
He, I suppose, part of the speculation here is the question that people think about is, had he lived, had he had the opportunity to continue to mature, how that focus might have developed, and in fact whether he would have moved on to becoming someone who was much more associated in a broader way with issues like, particularly like class and poverty, not just in the way that they affected Black Americans, but as I said, in the way that affects all Americans.
Yeah. Well, I think that there is absolutely no question that he would have. And my argument has always been that from Montgomery onward, King was moving in that type of direction. See, one of the things we have to always remember about Martin Luther King is that he was first and foremost a minister, a Baptist preacher. I mean, that's the way he often liked to characterize himself, and frequently he would talk about, you know, the many awards that he had won and all of that kind of thing. But he'd end by saying, but in the final analysis, I am and always have been a Baptist preacher. And what he meant by that, essentially, was that he was a man of faith, a man of God, as it were. And so King had this sense that, this clear understanding that the world and everything in it belongs to the God of his faith. And that is the God of the Hebrew prophets and of Jesus Christ. And consequently, he recognized or believed that since God was the author of all that there is, including human beings, and that God had created all of us in such a way that we have been imbued with the image and the fragrance of God, we are all one people under the one God of the universe. So King recognized really from the very beginning that we're all interconnected and interdependent, and consequently, if you know, injustice, if one experiences injustice in Champaign, Illinois, for example, and one happened to be a Kingian in her thinking, then one would also have a sense that the injustice in Champaign, Illinois, is a threat to injustice or justice in any other part of the country and the world. Mm. So I think that there's no question that had Martin Luther King lived, his socio-ethical outlook would have continued to expand, and he would have been right on board with a number of, you know, not just the, you know, issues of poverty, I mean, which are so so important, and we see those emphases in King from almost the very beginning as well, and particularly from the mid-1960s onward. You know, my sense has always been that his viewpoint would have expanded to include some even more provocative or controversial types of matters, the issues surrounding gay and lesbian rights, or homosexuality, for example, which is very provocative. And, you know, one might want to argue that, well, Martin Luther King, having grown up in a fundamentalist Baptist household in the Deep South, that, you know, King would have been against those types of things. And the truth of the matter is, when one reads into the Dr. King's papers, one does discover that early on, this would have been the late 1950s, early on in a segment that King used to write for Ebony magazine, it was an advice segment, he had received a letter from a young man who apparently was having what he characterized as homosexual tendencies and didn't quite understand what to do about that. Well, King was just a pastor at that time, and the response that he sent back, I mean, it's written in that Ebony advice column, was essentially the classical kind of response to that, you know, that probably he needed to get some psychological help about that. But the truth of the matter is, because of the way Martin Luther King's thought patterns and his behaviors changed over the years, I've argued that had he lived beyond 1968, that he would have been very much on board with things like gay and lesbian rights, and would have had a very different kind of given a very different kind of response to the question of homosexuality that he did back in about 1959 in that issue in Ebony. And then, of course, there's the whole matter of Martin Luther King and women. You know, the whole question of sexism, you know, it certainly cannot ever be argued that Martin Luther King ever hated women, that he was a misogynist, for example. I mean, that can't be argued in the way that it can be argued that there was a period, for example, in Malcolm X's development when he just hated women. You know, one can't argue that where Martin Luther King is concerned, and in part because of the way he was reared at home. I mean, his father loved his mother, and he treated her well, and he was a pretty good model in that respect. And then King just had this deep sense of respect for the dignity of human beings, period. But he did have an issue, though, around the whole issue of women in the public sector. And we discover that, for example, in the interworkings of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, of which he was president. And I think particularly of his relationship and the relationship of the male board members with Ella Baker at that time, who was the first director of the SCLC. And so Martin Luther King exhibited those kind of chauvinistic kinds of beliefs. And near the end of his life, we find that, of course, what one might characterize as the modern women's lib movement was really beginning to be afoot. And I think that Dr. King was certainly had a peripheral awareness of what primarily white women at that time were saying about women's rights. And my sense is, because of the way he was still growing and developing, is that he would have been very much on board with the women's movement had he lived a little bit longer. I think that it's no different with the issue of class as well.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, and also I want to introduce once again our guest, Rufus Burrow, Jr. He is Indiana Professor of Christian Thought at Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis, and has written on the theological ethics of Dr. King. In fact, he's author of a book that is titled God and Human Dignity, The Personalism, Theology, and Ethics of Martin Luther King, Jr., and it is published by the University of Notre Dame Press. And certainly questions are welcome. People like to join the conversation here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. toll-free 800-222-9455. And let's talk with someone here in Champaign. And this would be line number one. Hello.
Yes, this is fascinating. And, of course, Dr. King, it's hard to separate, in my estimation, race from class. They are interrelated. But wouldn't you say the circumstances in which Dr. King found himself at the time of his assassination in Memphis, where he was trying to work for an enhancement of the rights of the Memphis garbage workers, that reflected his sensitivity to issues, granted race, but also I would think for all Memphis garbage workers, including those who happen to be white, who were at the lower end of socioeconomic scale because of the injustices of Memphis. Am I right on that?
You are absolutely correct. You know, one of the things that Martin Luther King surely learned when he was a doctoral student at Boston University, and I did my work at Boston University as well many years later, about 20 years after Dr. King, and one of the things he must have learned, because I learned it there as well, about social problems, whether it be racism or classism and now sexism and heterosexism and all the rest, he must have learned, as I did, that social problems have a way of hanging together. You know, they kind of hang out together so that in the event one happens upon one of those issues, it's very likely the case that one or more of the others are very close by. So, no, I think it would have been impossible for Dr. King, and particularly by the late 1960s, to have easily separated issues of race and class. And my argument has continued to be that, had he lived a bit longer, the issue of the gender question would have been added there for him as well. And certainly there's the issue of militarism.
Yes, I would agree with you there, because I think his departure under great pressure by President Johnson to speak out against the Vietnam War and the militarism associated with that reflected his love of peace. But one final point, and I do believe that it was in the planning stage, if I'm not mistaken, for Dr. King to have led a poor people's march, I believe, in Washington, had he not been assassinated in Memphis. Am I right on that?
That's correct. That's correct. You know, back in 1986, Yolanda King, who, as you know, recently died suddenly at her brother's home out in California, Yolanda gave two addresses here at Christian Theological Seminary. The occasion was that of the annual youth meeting for the young people in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. And I happened to have come out on that Saturday morning to bring my then 9-year-old daughter, because I wanted her to hear what Yolanda had to say and hopefully get a chance to meet with her. I'll never forget that one of the things that Ms. King said near the end of the first lecture was about her father, and she talked about Dr. King and the Poor People's campaign that he was planning at that time. And in her view, that was such a radical move or step on his part, radical development on his part, and she had a good sense that in this country, at least, one of the ways to really get people riled up is to hit them in the pocket, as it were.
Yeah.
And Dr. King, of course, through his advisors and others, and his own experiences, had figured that out. But Yolanda said that, in her view, had because of what Dr. King was doing or trying to do or hoping to do through the Poor People's Campaign, her sense was that that was such a radical move that, he was going to be assassinated. There was absolutely no question in her mind that if he hadn't been assassinated on April 4th of 68 in Memphis, it was going to happen, and she connected that to the Poor People's Campaign.
Yeah, I'm reading a book now that just won the Pulitzer Prize for history for this year, The Race Beat by Gene Robertson. He says it was inevitable that Dr. King would be assassinated, just didn't know when.
Yeah.
When you get to notions of expanding beyond pure race to economic power with poor people, it became, in other words, almost a sure shot that someone would feel compelled in this society to take his life. So I think when he did move into clearly the socioeconomic or poverty or class issue, that was just too much to bear for the powers that be in this country. So
I concur.
It's really sad, but I guess that's what happens when you are maverick like Dr. King.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Well, thank you for
thank
the
you.
Call. I wonder, Professor Burrow, I must admit that for me the term personalism was something new. I guess it's not something that I've been familiar with as a school of thought.
Yeah.
If people are, of course, if they're interested in exploring in some detail how Dr. King's thought developed and who were his most important influences, they can look at God and human dignity. Yeah. But perhaps you could talk for just a moment about personalism, what it is, and how that informed Dr. King's worldview.
I can indeed. Well, I think the first thing I'll do is give a kind of nutshell characterization of what personalism is as a type of philosophy. In a nutshell, it means two things. First, that our ultimate reality, and for those, of course, who happen to be theists, that is to say, who believe in God like I do and King did, for those folks, it means that ultimate reality is God. So God is personal. That's the first tenet. And then the second is that persons have inherent dignity and worth because called into existence and sustained by God. I mean, those are the two basic tenets of the type of personalism that Martin Luther King believed in and tried to live. There are, I've argued in my book on personalism, which was published back in 1994, there are about 12 or 13 different types of personalism, but King was most influenced by that type, which was developed at Boston University back in the latter part of the 19th century and the first decade or so of the 20th century. Developed by Borden Parker Bound. And then King, of course, goes off to Boston University from seminary primarily because he wanted to study. I mean, he wanted explicitly to study the philosophy of personalism under then premier personalist in this country, Edgar Sheffield Brightman, who became his academic advisor. And then when Brightman dies, suddenly in King's first year, one of his proteges, L. Harold DeWolf, takes over as Dr. King's King's advisor. And so King essentially studies the philosophy of personalism under him. And, you know, one of the things I always like to say about the Boston personalist tradition is that for many years, you know, it was believed that the place in this country to go to study personalism was, of course, Boston University. And in my own research, of course, I discovered that, you know, but there wasn't only an East Coast branch of this personalism, but there was also a West Coast group, you know, out around USC and other places in the University of California system as well. But some of those people out that way, Ralph Tyler Flewelling, for example, who was at USC, those people were themselves Boston University graduates, and that is under Borden Parker Bound. So they took personalism west. But at any rate, when Martin Luther King gets to seminary, where he was initially introduced to personalism but then studies it much more formally at Boston University, King resonated to that way of thinking, and I've argued primarily because he had seen so many of the personalist traits within the context of his own upbringing in Atlanta, Georgia, and also through his experiences at the Ebenezer Baptist Church, his father's church. And so consequently, I argue for what one might characterize as a kind of homegrown or homespun personalism. I mean, King learned a lot about the notion that God is loving and personal just through his parents and through people at his church. He learned a great deal about the need to respect the dignity and the worth not only of his own people but of all people, and that primarily because he connected everything to God. And so we have to remember that for him, you know, King's type of personalism was a theistic type. you know, so that God was the creator and sustainer of all that there is. The way that Martin Luther King's personalism, however, differed in a radical sense, really, from that of his teachers, is that he tried to live it. Now, that's not to say that men like Peter Anthony Bertacci and Walter George Mueller, who was one of King's mentors at Boston University, and Dr. Bertacci taught him in the Hegel seminar when Brightman died suddenly. It's not to say that those men, who I got to know personally when I was a student there as well, it's not to say that they were not in their own right activists. But it is to say that they understood themselves primarily to be teachers in the academy, so that one did not expect, for example, to see them out in the streets marching every day, although they could be and were supportive of Dr. King and his efforts in the South. But it is to say that, you know, when Martin Luther King ultimately buys completely into this philosophy, and let there be no mistake about it, I mean, he did say in a number of places, particularly in Stride Toward Freedom, he did say that personalism, he accepted personalism, or what he referred to sometimes as personal idealism, as his fundamental philosophical point of departure. And, of course, whenever he talked about that, he always placed the emphasis on the idea of a personal and loving God and the dignity and worth of persons. So King essentially then takes this philosophy to the streets. And, of course, it begins to take on a different kind of look than it would in the classroom, primarily because of what it met, what it confronted in the street. I mean, the diehard kind of blatant racist tactics that many of the marchers and King himself experienced from Montgomery onward in the South, as well as in some places in the North, most particularly Chicago, so that his personalism began to take on what I like to refer to sometimes as the lived and true personalism. So he was really putting it to the test, and I'd say that right up until the time he was assassinated, Martin Luther King remained fundamentally personalistic in outlook. And I think what that also did for him, though, was it gave him a sense that human beings are not alone in the world, which is why I think that it's so important when we think about Martin Luther King that we remember always that he was a man of faith. I mean, so that King never had the sense that we humans are in this thing by ourselves or that God is ever absent, but rather he always had the sense that God was always present with us and working with us in history, and that it was important that we humans do our part. So that for him, the issue was never that of God not being present or God not doing God's part. The issue was always what are we as beings created in freedom and with a sense of self-determination, what are we as human beings doing to contribute to God's work in the world?
Let us talk with someone else who is listening. This is someone who is in Kankakee, not all that far away from us here, and this is line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
It seems to this caller difficult but necessary to extrapolate, and in the view of this caller, to maintain a godly focus, we need to have the simultaneous past, present, and future orientation of the larger understanding. Just as we might ask, what would Jesus do, we might also ask, what would that Baptist preacher, Martin, say? It might be instructive to posit the sound today or tomorrow of his sermons or speeches. Who today or tomorrow might speak most like that voice? And what might be the text and the major points? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, that's a very interesting question. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that comes to mind immediately is what happened in the lives of very many of us when Martin Luther King was assassinated. And, of course, in the immediate weeks, months, and years after that, and I still hear some of that today, this tendency that many folks have had to to view Martin Luther King as a kind of messiah figure. And, of course, the implication is that, you know, without such figures, I mean, we humans can make no moral advance. And that's a view that, you know, I would take issue with, and I'm certain, without question, that with Dr. King here today, he would too. It reminds me of something that the late poet June Jordan said once when people were constantly talking about, oh, we need another Martin Luther King, and we need another Malcolm, and we need another this one and that one. And she eventually ended by saying, well, the problem is, we're not going to have those specific individuals again in history. The problem is, the challenge is, we are the ones, every single one of us who is alive now, we are the ones that we've been waiting for. And that brings to mind something that the late Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel used to say, and I like to quote, and that is that, you know, some are guilty, all are responsible. And what he meant by that is very much what Martin Luther King would have meant by it, is that, you know, while, for example, in the case of racism, while African Americans are not responsible for the existence of racism in this society, the argument can be made that because we are self-determining beings created in God's image, while we're not responsible for the racism, we are, every one of us, responsible for the way we respond to it, so that we don't really need any more messiahs. I mean, it would be great to have another Martin Luther King figure on the scene, but the truth of the matter is Dr. King would be saying today that, in a sense, he blew it, also because of the way the leadership structure was set up through the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. I mean, what did we have? We had a kind of single leader type of leadership going on, with Dr. King right there at the center, receiving all of the attention and giving most of the leadership. And then we had this large board of essentially black Baptist preachers, and it was a mistake. One of the things Ella Baker did from the very start was to try to encourage Dr. King and the board of the importance of developing a more communal, grassroots style of leadership. And, of course, you know, the men fought her to the very end there, and she lost that battle with them. But I think when we look back now, she was right, and the men were wrong in this, because what happens? Dr. King is assassinated in Memphis. Dr. Abernathy then had been selected as the one to succeed him, and of course he saw that the Poor People's Campaign came to fruition. But the truth of the matter is, much of those kinds of things were not really successful. I mean, they were failures in a way. And so what we basically had when Dr. King was assassinated was we were left without a leader. Had Ella Baker's communal type of leadership approach been followed, then the movement very likely would have continued much more vigorously than it could have, or than it did, when Dr. King was assassinated. When Dr. King was assassinated, the leadership and all of the rest went to the grave with him. We don't need more messiahs. We need to wake up, each of us, and make our own contributions to making the world a better place in which to live.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Rufus Burrow. He is Indiana Professor of Christian Thought at Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis, has written on the theological ethics of Martin Luther King, Jr. And if you would like to read more about this in some greater depth, you might take a look at his book, God and Human Dignity, The Personalism, Theology, and Ethics of Martin Luther King, Jr. This book is published by University of Notre Dame Press. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. As always, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. The toll-free line is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Going back to a moment, as you outlined personalism and what this philosophy involves, if one accepts that kind of philosophy and you believe that all human beings are equal in the eyes of God, all are of equal value, and you decide that you're going to be a campaigner for human rights, then obviously you cannot say, I'm going to concern myself exclusively with the rights of this group of people, and the rest of those people, well, they're going to have to find their own leaders because I'm not going to worry about them. Well, you cannot do that, and he did not do that. Having said that, though, and the fact that I'm sure that people within the civil rights movement would have said, well, yes, of course, all people are equal in the eyes of God and all people have equal value. And yes, we really should be campaigning for human rights generally, not just for some people, but for everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, having said, well, I'm sure people would accept that idea, though. I wonder whether within the movement that the idea that really there should be a much more broadly, the orientation should be much broader. That is, it should include all people. When you talk about human rights, you're talking about human rights. Whether that was somewhat of a controversial idea.
Yes. Well, I think that's right, and I think there's no question that Martin Luther King ultimately comes to the recognition that the issue was really not just that of civil rights, but fundamentally it was an issue of human rights. And, of course, when King talked about human beings, I mean, King meant human beings. I mean, he meant all of us, and he did not mean this group or that group. He meant all human beings, all persons, which, unfortunately, even today, we find that people talk about human beings, but they really have in mind specific groups of people. I guess one of the things I'd want to say is that, you know, because I find this very interesting, you know, even when King has come out, particularly after the Riverside Church speech, the speech against the Vietnam War, and we know, of course, that two or three times prior to that, I think that was April 4th, 1967, two or three times before that, you know, King had made it very clear as to what his position was on the Vietnam issue, and he'd been beaten down by the White House and by a lot of his own advisors, as well as leaders of some of the other civil rights groups at that time. But yet, even when it is absolutely clear that, you know, he is just not going to turn back on this Vietnam issue, he does say in two or three instances, because he was questioned about it, I mean, if you spend so much of your time focusing on Vietnam, then what about, you know, the struggles of black people in his country? I mean, and so he found himself having to react to that kind of question a number of times. And each time he made it absolutely clear that, you know, race was still a primary concern of his. And, of course, all that said to me was, you know, I mean, he just recognized that his outlook was just expanding. That's all. So it wasn't that he gave up something in order to get to where he felt he needed to be by 1967. He just grew and developed, that's all. And so race continued to be included in that. I think that it is a very difficult thing, David, these days, to just focus generally on human rights without also having some kind of specific base out of which one operates. Now, what I mean by that is that, you know, we know that there are still specific kinds of issues in this country that need to be addressed. I mean, you know, race would only be one. You know, there's still the matter of sexism or the gender question. That's another, the issue of heterosexism. So my point is, you know, it seems to me that it's quite possible for one to be committed to human rights and fighting and devoting as much of her or his energies to that issue as one can, while also being focused, perhaps, in a specific community. Now, let me say what I give an example of what I mean by that. I was reading not long ago, it would have been very shortly after the tragedy down at Virginia Tech back in April, and I was at that time already reading some of Nikki Giovanni's works, and one of those I was working through at the time is entitled Racism 101. I was very much moved by something that she said in there regarding the issue of race and multiculturalism. Her comment was something to the effect that this country does not have as much of a multicultural problem as a biracial or bicultural problem. Now, she was talking about the academy at that time, and what she was trying to convey was the idea as to how easy it seems to be in the academy, particularly in the colleges and universities, and I'd say in the seminaries, how much easier it is, particularly for white faculty members, to be supportive of candidates for positions from other parts of the world. And these might well be candidates of color. They could be from the African continent, they could be from the Asian continent, they can be from the Caribbean or what have you. But how much easier it seems to be for them, in the interest of multiculturalism, to be open to the candidacy of people of color from other parts of the world. And Professor Giovanni's point was, but right here in the United States, where racism continues to be embedded in the very structures of this country, we still find it very difficult to take seriously the candidacies of African Americans in the academy, and would choose persons of color from other parts of the world over them still, when our real issue, it is a real issue for us in this country, of race. And so, you know, not multiculturalism, the problem, but a kind of biculturalism, you know, still the whole white-black issue. I think that Martin Luther King never lost sight of that, even though he was very much moving in the direction of a very strong and firm sense of multiculturalism and the importance of all people, you know, whether in the context of this country or all over the world, because we're all interconnected in that way, of all people working and moving and striving together to make for a more gentler and sweeter kind of community.
We have about 10, pardon me for interrupting you there, sir. I'm just going to say we have about 10 minutes left, and I have a couple of callers that I would like to bring in. I didn't mean to interrupt you, though, if you wanted to round out
I'm
your
done.
Time. All right. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign County. That's here where we are.
Okay.
Line number one. Mm-hmm. Hello.
Well, thank you for taking the call. This is an opportunity for me to try to relive and dredge memory here of... of those days, indeed. I was under the impression that the FBI surveillance of Dr. King was not only because of the anti-war positions that he took, but because of the economic positions. It seemed to me that in those days that any attempt to improve the lot of poor people was considered to be communistic.
Yes.
And that was part of the grounds that they used to justify surveillance and harassment, actually, of Dr. King and the organization supporting him.
Well, you are absolutely right about that, and the truth of the matter is that whole FBI involvement, the surveillances, can be traced back to the early days of the civil and human rights movement under Dr. King's leadership, and I think particularly, specifically, of Birmingham, for example. And there was this, we in this country frequently tend to, historically, have tended to just become almost maniacs to even hear the term communistic, communism. But it is the case that from the very beginning, the hope was, and in fact, I think we can trace it back even to almost, and not so much the FBI involvement, but the FBI was certainly getting close to being involved in that, because even in Montgomery, it is the case that one of King's major advisors, Byard Rustin, Byard was a very complex personality, but he was very skilled in Gandhian techniques, And that was one of the reasons that the Fellowship of Reconciliation sent him and Glenn Smiley to Montgomery in the early days of the bus boycott to kind of teach Dr. King those Gandhian techniques. Well, the truth of the matter is, Bayard Rustin was not only homosexual, so that could have caused problems for the movement at that time, but he had also been affiliated with the Communist Party, and word about that did get out, and of course the media could have had a frenzy with that. But what ultimately happens is that when King was advised of the concern that was being raised, and of course not wanting it to be a detriment to the movement, Bayard was asked to leave town, and he did that. Although the truth of the matter is they continued to converse with each other over the phone because Rustin was just excellent in terms of tactical kinds of things regarding nonviolence. And then, of course, we know that in various hotels, particularly into the 1960s and onward, into the various hotels that King would spend the night at or have meetings at and that type of thing as he traveled throughout the country. I mean, he was under surveillance for a very, very long time by the FBI. You might be aware, for example, that Mr. Hoover, John Edgar Hoover at that time, who was the director of the FBI, really pretty much had it out for Dr. King and was wanting to do everything in his power to discredit him. So, you know, frequently his telephone conversations were under surveillance and all of the rest. The rooms were bugged and all of that kind of thing. But and part of it, of course, was to prove that there was some kind of communist connection. That proof was never came to fore. But it's also the case that, Hoover was suspicious of some of King's more intimate kinds of relationships, and that could have been a way to discredit him as well, and perhaps I've said enough about that.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Urbana, and we'll be line number two. Hello.
Hi. Actually, I think you might have answered my question before I even asked it, but I was going to ask about Dr. King's relationship with Bayard Rustin. I had always, when I had learned that of Bayard's story, that had always convinced me that Dr. King would be in support of the gay rights movement nowadays. And so I guess I would just be interested to hear if you had any further comments on his relationship with Bayard.
Well, other than that, they remained very close. And, Bayard was a very, not only was he a very good tactical person, but, I mean, he was brilliant in his own right. Certainly a good conversation partner for Dr. King, and was one who would not hold back. If he felt that criticisms needed to be raised, he didn't hesitate to do that. Don't know if you are aware that the Oral History Library at Columbia University in New York City have in their library what is called Reminiscences of Bayard Rustin, and this one happens to be quite a thick thing, over 500 pages. But at any rate, in a number of places, Bayard talks at length about his relationship with Dr. King, and particularly during the Montgomery struggle. I learned some rather interesting things myself. I'm in process now trying to verify some of those things. For example, Bayard's claim that by the time he got to Montgomery, the boycott had been going on for about a couple of weeks or so. By the time he got there, he mentions to Dr. King the name of Gandhi. Now, Rustin says in the Reminiscences that King's response was something to the effect that he had heard of the man, but he didn't know much about his thinking. Now, of course, a red light went on in my mind because it didn't make sense to me. It didn't make sense because in following King's intellectual development, we discover in an essay that he calls refers to as My Pilgrimage Toward Nonviolence. I mean, it's absolutely clear that King was first introduced to the writings of Gandhi when he was a senior at Crozer Theological Seminary. And not only that, Keene himself talks about in that essay having gone to the University of Pennsylvania one weekend to hear Mordecai Johnson, who at that time was the president of Howard University, give two lectures on Gandhi. And then King says that immediately after those lectures, he ran out and bought about a half dozen books by and about Gandhi. And it's he suggests that he did some reading of Gandhi. I suspect that since he was still a full-time student at that time, I deal with full-time seminary students all the time, I suspect that he probably didn't read much of Gandhi during during that period, at least not as much as he would have liked for us to think. You know, students who are taking a full load of courses get to do quite a bit of reading for their classes. So there's not a whole lot of time left for outside reading. But at any rate, it is clear that, you know, King was introduced to Gandhi in seminary, so I just wondered, as I read the reminiscences, what Byard was talking about. But it might well be that he had some other things in mind as well. I just don't know exactly what they are. But I'm in process of trying to verify some of that. It is clear to me that when King began as the president of the Montgomery Improvement Association and as leader of the bus boycott, it is clear that he did not begin explicitly applying Gandhian principles. Now, we know that. You know, basically, the focus was on the New Testament ethic, that kind of, you know, love your enemy, turn the other cheek type of ethic, although in this case, it was clearly a resistive type of ethic because the people had made the decision to not ride the buses. But those were not Gandhian principles explicitly. That would happen only after Dr. King meets Byard Rustin and Glenn Smiley.
I'm going to have to interrupt. Forgive me, but I'm going to
have
to do that because we're here at the end, and we're just going to have to stop. I just have about enough time to say thanks. Our guest, Rufus Burrow, is Indiana professor of Christian thought, Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis, author of the book God and Human Dignity, The Personalism, Theology, and Ethics of Martin Luther King, Jr., published by the University of Notre Dame Press. And Professor Burrow, thank you very much.
David, thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
From Public Radio International, I'm Ray Suarez. On the next America Abroad, a marriage of inconvenience, the U.S. and the United Nations. America championed the U.N.'s creation, but often chafes at its operation. We'll travel to Sudan to see when the U.S. works with the U.N., and we'll visit the Human Rights Council in Geneva to see when it doesn't.
This afternoon at 2 here on WILL Urbana.
WILL programming is made possible in part by the U of I College of Law, offering students the resources of a major research university, a world-renowned faculty, and opportunities for active learning both in the classroom and beyond. More information and a schedule of upcoming public lectures are available at www.law.uiuc.edu.
It's coming up on noon Central Time. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, a special program.